Welcome to Warships Pod, and in this episode I'm engaged in conversation with Gary Blackburn, who's been on a few times before, and it always provides very interesting commentary and analysis on naval matters. So welcome, Gary.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be back.
And I suppose there's a lot going on in the naval sphere abroad, at home, and a lot not happening as well, I suppose. And we've got a fairly nutritious menu here, I think.
Yes.
So I think if we talk about the UK's Defence Command paper
first,
that would be a good one. Keep things at home before we go abroad.
Yeah.
So this was heralded as a very important publication when it came out a few weeks ago, and basically explains where things are for UK defence in light of the Ukraine war as part of the Integrated Review Refresh, which means, presumably, we thought that the government would be laying out all its concise and very well explained reactions to aspects of the Ukraine war, from how relevant tanks are to cruise missiles being flung around, and also naval aspects such as drones. So some people have called it a word salad, and that's how we describe it in the next edition of the magazine. From my point of view, it was a prime example of opaque and confusing and not very well articulated corporate oblique defence speak. So what did you think to it overall?
Yeah, I mean, I think word salads and corporate oblique opaque defence speaks is a fair summary. I think you have to read between the lines to get the messages. It's written in that kind of patois and code, but there is some interesting elements in there. The first thing I'd like to say, to be honest, just to get it on the record, is whilst I'm going to be critical, I think we have to be mindful of the fact that the people who put these things together are obviously operating in a very suboptimal environment. We all know the budget's insufficient, and therefore these documents often did, and this one certainly does, seem quite contradictory in parts. And I think you have to read the document, not just the document itself, but also the other things we pick up through the media, analysing the outputs from the Defence Select Committee inquiries, analysing the general media coverage and commentary as it pertains to defence and budgets. Obviously, we know that the situation as regards commissioned ships, for example, isn't what we'd want it to be. So I think they're operating very much in an imperfect environment, which possibly helps to explain why there's such verbal gymnastics in the document and why it's quite bland in some respects.
So in other words, what it's doing is the important messages are not necessarily what's in there, but what's been left out.
Definitely. That's a great way of putting it. The actual structure of the document's really odd, because normally with a defence white paper, you would have an assessment of what the military has, what it needs, what it's going to look like in the next few years. And that would be very early on in the document. And actually, so the document gets more interesting the more you read it. So the interesting bits are at the end. But what's slightly worrying, as I'll come on to some specifics in a second, is what's not in there rather than what is in there. So yeah, absolutely spot on in that regard. So it comes across as a very kind of general, a series of generalizations, some of which are very hard to disagree with. So it mentions at length the importance of threats, state-based threats. Who could disagree with that right now, obviously? Its stepping off point is the fact that since the last iteration of this was published in 2021, there has been a major invasion of a European state. Therefore, the threat picture has darkened and it's gotten worse. We know that Secretary of State Wallace has been saying this repeatedly in his other public utterances for some time. Who could disagree with that? There's an interesting bit towards the end of the document about wanting to have a forward presence and to be on the front foot in all different parts of the world, making a virtue of all the bases that we have, which, again, who could disagree with that? The problem, as we'll come on to it, of course, is many of the platforms and people and skills required to make that real, such as landing platform dock, are currently being gapped as a capability. So there's throughout this document, the rhetoric's great, but then the actual how do you actually do it and what with is what's not actually revealed. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, correctly, I think, were slightly bamboozled by the fact that there was no order of battle, there was no ORBAT, there was no description of what the actual composition of the forces would look like, which is actually quite unusual in the scheme of these things.
But the interesting thing about that was that when he spoke in Parliament when he outlined it and made his statement about it.
Yeah.
Ben Wallace did go into some detail on the budget side of it.
Yes.
But then he made this statement, which has got at some people's noses, which relates to what you're talking about there, the order of battle. So if I read what he said to MPs, our defence plans and the armed forces to deliver them must be robust and credible, not fantasy force designs, unfunded gimmicks or top Trump numbers. As Russia has so effectively proven, there is no point having parade ground armies and mass ranks of men and machines if they cannot be integrated as a single full-spectrum force sustained in the field under all demands of modern warfighting. That makes professional forces well-equipped and rapidly adaptable, supported by critical enablers and vast stockpiles of munitions. That is why in this document, honourable members, will not find shiny new announcements, comms-led policies driving unsustainable force designs, or any major new platforms for military enthusiasts to put up on their charts on their bedroom walls. And he, as you said, there's no orbat there. There's no diagram, as there was in the original integrated review paper of 2021, for example, for the Navy, which showed all the ships, the platforms that were in the Future Force 2030. And a few of those have already been whittled down or have gone. We're talking about survey vessels and some of the frigates, et cetera, et cetera. So there's been a process of cutting and trimming going on. Mm. And I think that the DCP is as you describe, and has basically been about them not knowing quite what to do in certain areas and being caught on the hop by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And also that they are in a process of transformation, which they're now having to accelerate. So they're having to cut numbers and change direction in one or two areas, because as you say, I think you've already indicated, there's no money. They don't have any money. It's the no money command paper. And so they don't want to admit to a force structure or a chart with ships to put on enthusiast walls, because of course it's very embarrassing when people point out that that chart has very little on it.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you look back in time, I analysed a lot of these documents over time. I wrote a paper looking at it from 1957 to 2010 and looking at the themes that come out from across time. So there's often a tension between the budget threat. And I think his colourful phraseology there is a little bit defensive in tone. And obviously, had the previous Prime Minister remained in office, who he backed, of course, then this document might look quite different. It might be a little less opaque and a little bit more on the front foot. I think a weakness in UK defence policy generally, going back decades, but crystallised here as well, is an over-reliance on new technology. And this sort of feeling that tech, the latest thing, can replace platforms and people, that you can do more with less fundamentally. And in some of what the document says is undeniable. Clearly you need good logistics, clearly you need good enablers, clearly you need excellent ISTAR. And I'm not being a Luddite saying there's no value in having quantum computing or lasers or artificial intelligence or any of these things. I think the problem, or being very cunning with our plans, which is also in the document somewhere, the answer to that is, yeah, of course, all of those things matter, but you're dealing with adversaries. To be fair, I think where our adversaries have an obvious advantage is that they're authoritarians. They don't have to really worry about getting re-elected. They don't have to worry about spending vast quantities on health and education and much else besides. So there are some big bureaucratic restraints on them, but not many really. So if Chi decides to build a tonnage of new warships every 3 years, equivalent to the size of the RN, he can do it. So our polities, our nations are definitely operating at a disadvantage. I think, to be fair, I think one of the lessons from Ukraine, looking at the other side of the hill and the poor, relatively poor performance of the Russians, although you could argue it's gotten better, is that they lack some very basic abilities which we have prioritized over time, like ISTAR. And of course, if you can identify the target, if you can surveil the target, and if you can hit the target quicker, then obviously that is a force multiplier. The problem with that logic is that mass has a beauty all of its own. So the Russians still have a lot of mass. So they can burn through that mass and still prevail. And if you haven't got any mass, then you have to be perfect every single time. You and I both know that if we lost just a couple of warships, we'd be have all kinds of drama, all kinds of problems. We don't even have the resilience that we had in 1982. We could absorb a degree of punishment in 1982. It's not obvious to me that we can do that now, even though individual platforms are obviously more powerful than they were then and are plugged full of amazing equipment, is designed in a way so it can be upgraded. So when people talk about spiral development, which is a new phrase which has entered the lexicon, all that it's really talking about is the ability to upgrade sensors or upgrade weapon systems to the latest iteration. So in a way, that's not new. I could cherry pick quotes from reviews over decades, 1981, 1957, 2010, on the subject of technology, where the theme is always the same. Actually, things are getting more complex. Platforms are vulnerable. We need fewer of them, but they need to be better armed or have better sensors. I mean, 1981, which was one of the most infamous defense reviews, which made the decision to sell Invincible to Australia, which turned out to be falsified by events a few months later, obviously, with the Falklands War breaking out. Nevertheless, the thinking in this, well, look, we're going to have fewer frigates and destroyers, but they're going to be better armed. So this idea that you can cut but get away with it, in military terms, or naval terms, or strategic terms, is a recurring thing. But it's particularly acute in this document. And I just did a little bit of a few sums. I just looked at some of the key words in the document and worked out in percentage terms how many times they were figuring. Technology came out, I think 31% of keyword mentions that I calculated referenced technology. The other thing that comes through an awful lot in the document is allies and the importance of allies. Again, this is the allies are again seen as a force multiplier. But the problem with this is that ultimately your allies would like you to have some force to multiply as well. And that's what's absent in the document, literally absent in the document, because there's no OBAT. The document, if I'm being honest, feels like it would have looked quite different had political events moved in a different direction. Yeah. The other elephant in the room, obviously, is inflation. So even though the overall size of the budget has gone up, it's really budgets have to be judged in terms of outputs, which is about, even though they might not like it, it's about platforms and people. The platforms and people are going down. The budget clearly isn't going up sufficiently quickly.
One of the things that just strikes me, it's a recent news story, just a normal news story of a warship coming home, is the fact that we have HMS Albion coming home from spending quite a few months in the Baltic and around the North Sea. And as you've mentioned already, and with HMS Bulwark, the sister vessel, supposed to be the Total Warfare flagship that takes over. And at one stage, 10, 15 years ago, both of those vessels were in service. And we had Ocean as an LPH, a landing platform helicopter. And we also had 4 landing ship auxiliaries as well. Now we've got 3 landing ship auxiliaries scattered around the world. We've got no LPH and we've got Albion coming back, going into reserve, into mothballs, whatever you want to call it. And there are rumours that she's not going to be refitted and that maybe somebody like Brazil will buy that ship at some stage, and Bulwark is actually not ready to take over. So as you said, gapping. And documents like the DCP are full of references to littoral groups. I think, do they call them littoral strike groups? I'm trying to find it in my copy of it here. Littoral strike groups. Littoral strike groups being sent to the north and the south. And the next one that we'll deploy, which I think is littoral strike group south, is going to be led by RFA Argus. I had a look up a few statistics, these sort of things that Ben Wallace hates, you know, that us enthusiasts look at, which was that Albion, if I remembered properly, which I did, was completed in 2003, a modern all-seeing, all-dancing vessel. I've visited both several times, with all that you need to command a littoral strike group. And Argus, a merchant vessel, was completed in 1981. So you're talking 22 years before Albion was completed. Yep. And was purchased by the Navy in 1984. And yet, in essence, that imperfect vessel, which again, I've been aboard a few times. In fact, when they tried to use her as an amphibious vessel off the Balkans, and she was not fit for task then, but is now 30-odd years since I saw what a mess they made of using Argus in the Adriatic for a commando carrier. This vessel is now being sent instead of a fully-fledged LPD with all the tech, all the command stuff that you need. And I find that is the thing. When you're talking about the new tech, the drones, etc., the immature technologies that they're working on, which is what we should have But that's the thing that I find rather worrying about the Royal Navy and the way that the UK approaches defence, in that we would actually get rid of or not look after a ship like Albion and just have one of them in service and only refit them infrequently, and send this ancient former merchant vessel that is far from perfect to do their job. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, and I think that just speaks to this gap between rhetoric and what can actually be readily put to sea. I think, and it's a worry, because when the document talks about threats, there's nothing in there I disagree with it. The threats are there, they're here, they're now, they're many and varied. And it's not just Russia and it's not just China. There's a hell of a storm brewing up in West Africa at the moment, which the French have been involved with famously in Mali. That's escalating and spilling over into countries like Burkina Faso. And that's to do with gold mines and uranium mines, and a lot of that illicit trade comes out in places like Togo on the West African seaboard. And the Wagner Group are all over it. The Russians are there as well. And the Chinese are obviously not too far away as well. And so you might well need a littoral response group south with an LPD to go onto a contested beach at very short order. And whilst the French and the Americans are on the lead on that one, it's inconceivable, I think, that they wouldn't ask for support, or that we wouldn't have a direct interest in making sure uranium and gold didn't get into the hands of nefarious actors. So everything that's in the document is correct in terms of its threat analysis. But as we said at the beginning, it's what's not in the document. I mean, other things that worry me is there's a good reference to the purchase and the fitting of the naval strike missile, which you and I would both agree is a really good idea.
Yeah.
But then
yeah,
there's no reference to, for example, future cruise anti-ship weapon. There's no reference to Spear Cap 3, which is the weapon, really. Those two weapons are the ones which actually make carrier strike real in terms of the high point of our conventional deterrence. And there's no reference to them, which I find slightly disturbing, because we know they're not going to come on stream for another 5-7 years. But why would you not make reference to them? Presumably you'd want to crow about that. So the good news is coming around the corner. You know, it might be jam tomorrow, but it's jam and it's on its way. So that to me seemed weird, a weird omission when you'd mentioned the naval strike missile, which I guess is coming into service, well, this year, next year. So it's closer in time, but it just seems a bit odd that you wouldn't mention that. I don't know. But as I said at the beginning, I didn't write the thing, so there may be valid reasons. But as an analysis of the text, I did find that slightly odd and a bit worrying.
When you were talking just then, I just thought that you were referencing Russia and China being in Africa and about what that's really all about. And I was thinking the Russians and the Chinese are leveraging what they have got. And also they seem to be approaching the world in a far more ruthless, pragmatic and brutal in gaining their objectives, while we appear certainly in European NATO and in fact the UK to be not just like a rabbit in the middle of the road, caught in the headlights of the oncoming potential conflict, let's say, with Russia and China, but actually a rabbit that's very busy grazing on some kind of vegetation in the middle of the road, is not even noticing what's coming. Because I think that the Russians and the Chinese, you said they can more easily build up their stuff because they're not democracies in the same way that we are. But it just seems to me that they are clearly bent on being as ruthless, as aggressive as they can, where they can, to get what they can of the world's resources, get territory. Sometimes it didn't work for the Russians in Ukraine. And we are knowing, as the DCP explains, that Russia and China are threats, and we know what they're going to do, but we're conning ourselves that the emperor's new clothes of lovely tech that will reduce on the cost of these horrible old platforms like warships and tanks and things, and can be operated by different sorts of people, because we can't recruit enough people either to actually operate some of these ships and other things. And we're deciding that's the way to go, and yet this juggernaut is coming towards us. I don't know if that's an apt description, but I do fear that the juggernaut is going to hit us.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And the other day I was looking at some figures relating to materials, minerals, which, you know, absolutely critical to the modern world, things like components that go into batteries, semiconductors. And the Chinese grip on that is incredibly powerful. I know it doesn't have the super advanced semiconductors which are produced in Taiwan via an American design, but nevertheless, so much of what else is required for the modern world is actually controlled by Beijing. And actually, and people gloss over this, but actually a lot of it's controlled by the Russians as well. And I did read something as well, which I found quite disturbing. Obviously, we've been rightfully, in a way, engaged in economic warfare with the Russians, but their economy, according to the IMF, is going to grow by 1.5% this year, which is better than Germany or Britain. So they've rode out that storm. You know, I think they've rode it out because they produce primary goods, which are actually essential to everything else, the oil, gas, platinum, and many other minerals. And so there's always going to be a huge demand for it. My worry, actually, and actually the document, to its credit, does touch on this, is that, and this is a geopolitical point, is that Russia and China now are, their alliance is deepening fairly rapidly, partly because of the economics, because China can obviously hoover up Russian oil and gas at a cheap cost, as can India. And I know some people hope that China would fall out of Russia, and that the Chinese covetously eye Siberia and maybe would even attack Russia. I think that's absolutely, that's just wishful thinking on an epic scale. You saw, I'm sure, the other day there was a report of a joint Russian-Chinese naval grouping.
Yes, I saw that, 11 ships off the Aleutians.
Off the Aleutians, four American destroyers went out to intercept them. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. That alliance is really, they're not just about prime ministers and presidents. They're about the two militaries working hand in glove over time, develops connections and friendships, and that embeds these alliances. And I can't help but feel, and then if you look at the Russian economy, why is it still going? Actually, when all the Western businesses left, they were taken over by Russians who just tweaked the brands, and also by the Chinese. And if, when the war ends, any kind of rapprochement with Russia, I think it's going to be incredibly difficult, because they probably don't want Starbucks to come back, because actually they're running their equivalent of Starbucks right now, and it seems to be going fine. So I think Russia, looking at the big picture, I think Russia is gone. Yeah, Putin might be toppled. Yeah, he's going to die at some point. I just think it's gone.
But when you say gone,
I think the attempt to, the not very successful attempt back in the 1990s to bring Putin into the fold. We used to have the G8. Russia was in the G8. That's gone. There's obviously in the document that they're hedging the bets with China, saying we don't think it's inevitable that there's going to be conflict with China, holding out a carrot to China, saying you can still back away from the Russians and do business with us. Sadly, I think that's ever more or less likely. I think so. That operation off the Aleutians wouldn't surprise me in the least if we see quite a lot more of that. And I just see it deepening. And then to your point about we're like a rabbit in the headlights, or a rabbit just munching vegetation. Those kind of developments on the other side of the hill really just add weight to what you're saying, as that, you know, the clock is ticking. I mean, ultimately, you know, obviously we're all ultimately relying on the Americans, but there's an election next year in America, isn't there? And my gut instinct tells me that Putin is just waiting to see what happens with that.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're going to get back to a situation where cooperation, if not friendship, with Russia was possible. And sadly, I don't think that's going to be the case with China either. I think it's too late. I think it's gone.
Yeah, you're right, I think. And in looking at the war in Ukraine, the Ukraine war, talking of, you know, we were talking about gold and minerals and things you need for chips, etc., you know, in Africa or wherever, uranium for all sorts of things, nuclear power. And of course, grain has been in the news.
Of course.
And if you look at the Africa-Russia summit or whatever it was called, in St. Petersburg, which we look at and cover in the next edition of the magazine, the one's just about to come out within the next week or so. Then, of course, Putin invited African strongmen to St. Petersburg. He showed them his naval might there off Kronstadt in the Gulf of Finland. You know, they all had a big powwow. And one of the big things he made capital on was the fact that Russia has been and continues to supply grain to Africa. And he said that in one of his speeches, he said that in 2022, 11.5 million tons of grain were delivered to African countries. And in the first 6 months of this year alone, we supplied almost 10 million tons. And this is despite the illegal sanctions imposed on our exports, which seriously hinder the supply of Russian food, complicate transport logistics, insurance and bank payments. And then he emphasized that he would make sure to his dear friends that they would get grain. So that grain is a weapon as well, isn't it, against Ukraine and also in winning over world opinion and gaining influence.
Yeah, 100%. And the propaganda that the Russian propaganda there illustrates that they can be quite skillful on that level. And actually, I saw some opinion polling data from those West African countries like Niger and Mali and Burkina Faso, and the Russians are actually really popular in those countries. And yeah, so you can weaponize grain in that regard. And the quid pro quo is that you get access to the uranium and the gold. And again, one of the inbuilt competitive advantages that authoritarians have is that they're not going to lecture somebody about their human rights record or their values not being what we would expect. And when you have been several coups d'etat in Africa, those military leaders, they're not interested in Western values. They're interested in who's going to feather their personal nest the best and make sure they're physically secure. I mean, the Wagner Group are there really as hired muscle. They're there to make sure that whatever potentate is in power stays in power. And then they go on the grain side. Yeah, obviously we're going to get on, I guess, to the incidents in the Black Sea using uncrewed surface vessels. It's a tit-for-tat situation. I mean, what's fascinating about this war is that on certain dimensions, it does resemble total war. But in other areas, there is a degree of restraint. But then something escalates. So the Ukrainians hit the Kerch Bridge, and then the grain deal is suspended by Russia, who then pound Odessa. And then the Ukrainians respond tit for tat style by attacking the landing ship in Novorossiysk a few days ago. I mean, it's interesting. I think there's two ways of looking at it. What's the effect of this on the war? I think the Black Sea has actually been a very important theater in the war. I think in terms of Russia applying coercive power to Ukraine, it's been an important front in that regard. It has whittled away Ukrainian GDP. Ukraine's GDP fell by about 30% last year. And obviously, some of that is tied up with being able to export grain and other primary products. So that is a way of applying economic warfare against Ukraine. I've been really impressed, actually, with the way Ukraine have managed to punch back.
And the other side of the grain thing, of course, was that the Russians were exporting their grain to their clients in Africa or wherever around the world, in the Middle East or wherever it was. And it allowed the Ukrainians to also export theirs, as you just explained, to enhance their income. And apparently, the World Food Programme obtained half of its grain from Ukraine in 2022. And 2021. So in now saying, we're not going to play ball anymore and we're going to attack your grain shipments. And they have attacked also the grain ports as well with cruise missiles. The Russians are successfully piling pressure diplomatically, I would assume, trying to apply pressure on the Ukrainians to come to the table and negotiate some kind of peace settlement, aren't they?
Yeah, there is this tit-for-tat coercion that's going on. So I don't know. I guess that will either continue and escalate, or they will reinstate the deal. I think the problem for the Russians is that you can only use grain as a weapon so far, because obviously if you alienate opinion in Africa or in parts of Asia, then you're obviously persona non grata in the West, then you've got to be careful that you don't turn your current friends against you. I mean, the whole, you'll recall the Arab Spring revolutions around about 2011, which led to us intervening in Libya. That all started because the price of bread had gone through the roof in Tunisia. And the riots started in Tunisia and then spread to the rest of North Africa. So the Russians, it's not a one-way weapon. They have to be quite careful. I think where the Ukrainians really are hurting the Russians is obviously if they completely destroy the Kerch Bridge, then that makes it very difficult for the Russians to keep that part of that annexed territory viable. And a large part, I think we can now see, of what they're doing is really about Crimea. It is about the Donbass as well, but it's about a buffer zone within Ukraine proper to make sure that Crimea is secure. The mass bombardment of Odessa, I think, is Putin's way of saying, actually, you've hurt us there. That hurts. If you destroy that bridge, that hurts us. We're going to take the gloves off. Because the gloves are on. I mean, that's a really weird thing about all this.
They are.
Some people might listen to this and think, what the hell is he talking about? The gloves are on. But they are actually on. They've not used tactical nuclear weapons. They've not used the truly heavy ordnance, conventional ordnance that they have. So
yes, you're right. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. The attack on the Kerch Bridge that then led to the end of the grain deal. It was interesting that the Russians were then, while the roadside of the Kerch Bridge was out, were then using the, and I'll get the name wrong here, but I'll try and pronounce it, Olenegorsky-Gorniak, Rapucha-class landing ship, and yep. another one to transport people and vehicles as a ferry service. So right. the Ukrainians decided that they would send a drone, I don't know where it's being operated from, but send a drone all the way to the, yes. the eastern side of the Black Sea to lurk off Novorossiysk, which I've been there myself and I've seen that for years has been a military. A lot of the airborne forces that went to fight in Ukraine came from around that area, but it's also a naval base and an oil exporting hub. And they managed to damage the landing ship and flood one side of the landing ship, giving it a list and a serious hit, I would say. And I think the drone was reputedly carrying about 450 kilograms, 992 pounds of yeah. explosives. So that's like an impact from a surface running torpedo, not one that can do really sink a ship by getting underneath and exploding and creating a gas bubble to break the ship in two. It's like something you'd see in the American Civil War, perhaps. One of those yes. Submersible craft, because they had them then. They had people in them, but they were like steam-powered or pedal-powered or whatever they were, heading for the other vessel. So it would be the Confederates heading for the Union yes. ship, you know, back in yeah. the mid-1800s, and seeking to place a charge against the waterline. And that's what that drone did just the other day. And then we had the merchant vessel, a tanker, said to have been taking jet fuel to Russian naval air arm squadrons, attacking troops, Ukrainian troops, probably in the south, and took that out in ballast, not when it was carrying the fuel, but didn't yep. actually, I say took out, I keep saying that, it didn't take it out, it damaged it, so that vessel again was damaged. So they've managed to damage two vessels and I suppose have a psychological impact on the Russians and make headlines and PR.
I think what's fascinating about all of this is, to some extent, it levels it up. It's obviously, as you said, you know, this on one level, there's nothing new about this. Ships being sunk in the harbour is not new. Using stealthy methods of doing that is not new. And it brought to my mind, was it the sinking of Queen Elizabeth and Valiant and Alexandria Harbour?
By Italian man torpedoes in December 1941.
Yeah, that's immediately what I thought of when I saw that. But, you know, it's interesting that these vessels apparently have about 450 nautical mile range, so they can be piloted from a long way out, and as you said, carry quite a lot of explosive as well. The other thing that made me think straight away is sort of validates the Type 31 design, I think, the new HMS Ventura, which is being built at the moment, because that's got a lot of guns on it for close-in defense, 40mm guns, 57mm, obviously lots of machine guns. The trick is being able to actually identify that you're under attack. Because obviously the radar signature is going to be hard to pick up. And therefore, it is quite similar to a torpedo. I think that design of the Type 31, I remember I looked at the Type 31, the original design, and thought, well, this is undergunned. Not undergunned literally, but underarmed, because it didn't have many missiles on board. It did have a lot of guns. And now, of course, it's being fitted for, is it the Mark 41 VLS launcher? But it still retains lots of guns. So from a defensive perspective, the RN may be looking at it saying, that one probably fits with the current trends. We've probably got that right. I suppose the other thing it does is bring into sharp relief and focus, though, not just for Ukraine and Russia, but for everybody, is the vulnerability of ports. And, you know, God forbid, but if we get involved in this thing directly, we're near where you're based, you know, obviously Devonport, Portsmouth, Faslane, et cetera, et cetera. Do they need to look at sort of passive measures to make sure? Because if we go back to World War II, you know, the sinking of the Royal Oak, and then Scapa Flow has to be abandoned as the main fleet base. And I think many ships were actually transferred from Malta to Alexandria because Malta wasn't safe. But the Navy still managed to conduct business, which I think is what the Russians will do. They'll find a way to keep going. But obviously you'd like to forestall that if you can. And actually, going back to the DCP, there's an element of thinking in there, actually, about the RAF, really, about air dispersal. Dispersing, the RAF's got hardly any major fighter bases left. So if it were attacked, they're now thinking about, well, how do we disperse Cold War style? If Marham's attacked, where do we go to? That kind of thing. But there's a naval consideration there around port vulnerability. I don't know. What do you think?
I cannot imagine when you see all the paddle boarders and the pleasure craft or whatever ferries out there, that they're going to tolerate any kind of Russian-style, you know, shore batteries or dolphins trying to find frogmen or whatever. I don't know. It just seems that we do need to think about things like that. The thing I was thinking about when you were talking about the Type 31 was that people will probably say, oh, yeah, but big ships like that, the drones just show how vulnerable they are. But when you look at the videos of the Rapucha-class ship, and I think the tanker too, there wasn't a lot of light discipline there. Probably, I suspect somebody was faulty on watch, and I think they were caught napping. I think the Ukrainians were probably waiting for just such an opportunity. And as you say, they probably didn't have a lot of the right weaponry to deal with it. And for example, there's the Martlet has been tried on the Type 23,
yes,
which is an anti-drone weapon fitted to an anti-aircraft, I think a 30mm cannon. There are things that the UK has looked at. Maybe it hasn't installed them all and hasn't got them all up and running, but there are elements of what happened to these Russian ships, which I think were down to poor vigilance, being silhouetted in the case of the Rapucha against the harbour lights. You know? And if you're in a war condition and you know that the Ukrainians have already attacked Novorossiysk, you've still got your lights blazing for the silhouette of the ship to be visible, just, you know, off the coast of the USA in 1942 during the U-boat's second happy time. They were able to destroy terrifying amounts of often British shipping because we weren't allowed to protect them off the US coast, but silhouetted against Coney Island or whatever, or other coastal resorts where they wouldn't turn the lights off. So I think that there are elements of these incidents that maybe get overlooked in some of the coverage of it, which explain why it happened and why they were able to cause such damage.
Well, it was lit up like a Christmas tree, as was the shoreline. Yeah, and you're right. It was just like the American Eastern Seaboard in 42. The happy time. But I suppose in a way that does speak to port security, doesn't it? You're right. I don't think people in Plymouth and Portsmouth are going to be happy about switching all the lights off just yet. But if you were to take that away, easy to apply lessons in a real crisis, obviously people in the UK would be well aware of those already. But again, it does illustrate the enduring value of that kind of activity. I mean, interesting, there's always been a big academic debate when new technology and new weapons are brought to bear, which goes by the phrase revolution in military affairs. And obviously, because the DCP is laden with references to technology, one question obviously people will be asking is, do these weapons, do these vessels, do these aircraft represent a revolution in military affairs? I think on one level, they don't. I think, you know, things like tanks have always been vulnerable to air attack. I think the only thing that makes them particularly interesting is the cost of these weapons is very low. And I think that does allow third-tier powers like Iran, Turkey, Ukraine to punch above their weight. It's more of an open question about the relevance of them to tier one and tier two powers like the UK as to whether or not you go down that path or whether or not you stick with your cruise missiles, you stick with your torpedoes, you stick with your anti-shipping missiles. We're going to be fighting, if we are fighting, in the Atlantic or the Pacific. So it's a different tactical and geographical setup. But there's a lot for them to chew over, I think, in that regard.
I think what you say about the leveller is a very interesting point and, again, has a precedent in history because that's what torpedoes in their early days back in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and those horrible little puny things submarines were all about. And that's why British admirals and others, French admirals, whatever, were outraged. The mere idea of an underhand thing like a clockwork or steam-powered or whatever it was, motorised explosive charge coming at one of their lovely battleships or a puny little craft lurking beneath the sea and then hitting them in exercises pre-World War One, pre-other conflicts as well, before World War One, and winning the exercise. They were absolutely outraged by it, but they couldn't ignore the fact that nations that didn't have a battle fleet, didn't have all these pre-dreadnoughts or dreadnoughts, could invest in technology like submarines and also torpedoes, and they could try and equalize the situation in any kind of conflict, or at least get some kind of edge in certain areas. So I think we are at that moment again. But another lesson of that is that may have happened, let's say, between 1900 and 1916-17, but battleships, aircraft carriers, normal warships, you know, as history proceeded from battleships to aircraft carriers through World War II, and we had frigates and destroyers, they're all still there. The panoply of naval platforms are there. But as you say, they adapted and people came up with measures, didn't they, to counter the infernal torpedo and submarine.
Well, yeah, for sure. And obviously, you know, the history of the Battle of the Atlantic, land-based aircraft were obviously very pivotal in dealing with that particular threat, as obviously with surface ships as well and escort carriers. So there's always a response. That's the thing about warfare. You know, somebody invents a sword, the next guy invents a shield, or the guy invents a bigger sword. So you're always going to have that. And but I say the tier three powers, as you said, you know, they have always found a way of raising the costs, which is what the Ukrainians have done here. They've raised the costs for the Russians of doing what they're doing. There's almost, via the military, this is a very Klaus Schwitzian point. You know, he said war was the continuation of politics by other means. There's almost a dialogue going on using weapons and drones and hypersonic missiles. That's a form of dialogue, and in which the Ukrainians are saying, okay, you can hit us, but we can hurt you. They attack Moscow. They are attacking Moscow. I mean, not to any great effect, but the psychology of it, I don't know. I don't know if that's beneficial or not, because Putin might say, well, I told you there was a threat, so now they've demonstrated there's a threat. So his propaganda might use that the other way around. But yeah, I think it's reasonable, I think, for the Ukrainians to do these things. It's reasonable for them to hit out at Russian territory. Although, be mindful of the fact that I don't think anyone really knows how this whole thing actually ends and then what that ending looks like. I suspect if it is going to end, it's probably next year. Time will tell on that one.
And that concludes part one of our Warships Pod chat with Gary Blackburn. Join us in part two for a discussion about topics relevant to the epic movie Oppenheimer and a look into the latest developments on UFOs. And by the way, you can read my review of Oppenheimer and also the latest Mission Impossible movie in the current edition of Warships IFR, the September magazine. And we also have features on UK strike carriers being back in action, Russia's Black Sea grain gambit, and the US Navy suffering some submarine problems in terms of getting vessels to sea. There's also an interview with the boss of the Bulgarian Navy, a look at Sweden's fleet in NATO, and something on the Talisman Sabre exercise off Australia. It's an action-packed edition. For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at warshipsifr, and also Twitter at warshipsifr. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.